This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. A lot going on in the nation's capital this week. Yesterday, the Senate passed a roughly $3.5 trillion spending plan. That on the heels of passing a $1.2 trillion bipartisan infrastructure plan on Tuesday. And it's still not a done deal, not even close. Right now, the larger spending package is just a big number, a list of priorities, and lawmakers now have to get to work on the long process of actually drafting the legislation that would determine how the money gets spent. Meanwhile, the House isn't ready to vote on the smaller bipartisan transportation infrastructure bill. That's the $1.2 trillion one. Progressives in the party want to flesh out the bigger package first, and it could be hard to keep all the coalitions in place through all of that. So $4.7 trillion total hang in the political balance. Will it make it across the finish line? We checked in with Massachusetts Senator Ed Markey, just last hour to see if he could help shed some light on all of this. And I started by noting two big packages totaling several trillion dollars passed in the Senate. That's a lot in one week.
It was a lot, but it didn't just happen overnight. Like many things, it built actually from last year on the infrastructure bill, where Trump kept having infrastructure week after infrastructure week. And I serve on the Transportation and Infrastructure Committee. So we had finished a big part of the bipartisan bill last year. We brought it forward, and we were able to bring in some Republicans who said that they would defy the Trump tweets and work on a bipartisan bill. And the big news for Massachusetts is we have $4 billion for highways in the bipartisan bill. We have $1 billion for bridges to be repaired. We have $2.5 billion for the MBTA and other transit. We have money for electric vehicles. We'll have hundreds of millions of dollars for broadband deployment inside of Massachusetts, inside of that legislation. There's also money for electric vehicles. There's money for electric buses in there for Massachusetts. And that's before we reach the $3.5 trillion bill that's going to be all Democratic.
So, Senator, let's start with the $8 billion that comes out of the smaller bipartisan $1.2 billion kind of roads and bridges package. How do you get that one over the finish line, especially given that there's argument within the Democratic Party on whether or not the $3.5 trillion larger spending package needs to get legislated first?
Well, we're going to be sending both of these bills over, and it's a combined $4.7 trillion, $1.2 trillion in the bipartisan bill and $3.5 trillion in the Democrat-only bill. And what Nancy Pelosi has made very clear is that neither bill will move until both bills move over there. And she has the control over that process. So she's not sending them back to us until both of those bills have the votes to get a majority, and then...
Do you agree with that strategy, Senator? I mean, that is a decided strategy, and some would say that it places potentially the bipartisan bill at risk.
Well, again, that's in a way a paradox for the Republicans. They have to understand that to the extent to which the bill that they agree with can pass both chambers, both bills have to be able to pass. So procedurally, it actually puts the onus on the Democrats to get the 50 votes ultimately to send it over, which we did. And then it puts the onus on the Democrats in the House to work together in order to get the votes to pass out the bipartisan bill and the Green and Family budget resolution as well. So I think we're going to get it done. I have every confidence that Nancy Pelosi and the Progressive Caucus can work together in order to get the votes for both of those bills and then send it back to us. And we would then send it to President Biden for his signature. But ultimately, no climate, no deal. That is, if the green budget resolution gets watered down, then that's going to cause big problems.
And so let's talk about that.
Okay, sure.
So you've got, there are climate measures in the smaller $1.2 trillion bill that has been passed on a bipartisan basis in the Senate. I want to take these two things separately. Is there enough, if that is the only thing that gets passed, and I understand there are procedural dealings going on, is there enough in that bill to satisfy you? Because if not, then I'm assuming that means you need to see the whole $4.7 trillion as one bundle in order to be behind it yourself when it comes back to the Senate.
Well, I would say this, that yes, there's money in the bipartisan bill for our power grid, you know, $65 billion. I mean, right now, Thomas Alva Edison would recognize our electric grid. So it has to be modernized for wind and solar, and has to be modernized for energy efficiency and managing the electricity coming in off of the ocean or off of the deserts or people's roofs. That has to happen. And there's some money in for electric charging stations, some money in for electric school buses. And I would say all of that is a good start. It's a good start. But the big, big investments are in the reconciliation bill. That's the $3.5 trillion bill. And we received a warning from the UN this week that the planet and all of humanity is on a code red alert. And the only way we're going to respond to it is with a green budget resolution. So they're tied together. We know that the planet is dangerously warming. We know there are no emergency rooms for planets. We know we have to put the preventative measures in place. And those are all in the big bill, the tax breaks for wind and solar. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, so I was going to say, connect those dots for us. So we covered the UN report earlier this week here on Radio Boston, tried to take a good local focus on it. In that $3.5 trillion, there's more than climate. There are a number of other things as well. But what are some of the specific policy measures that you want to see in the final plan for how that $3.5 trillion would get spent that matter to Massachusetts and matter to that UN report?
Okay, well, the UN has now given us our final warning. And that report says that our responsibility is unequivocal and the effects of the climate crisis are unprecedented. And we have an undeniable call to act. And so inside of the big Democrat-only bill are tax breaks for wind and solar, all electric vehicles, for battery storage technologies, and we have to get it passed. So that'll be hundreds of billions of dollars over a 10-year period for that. We need a climate bank, a climate accelerator, so that we can have low-interest loans to cities and towns and small businesses and larger businesses all across the country. And for every dollar we put up, the private sector is saying they'll put up $7. So that climate accelerator could unleash hundreds of billions of dollars of investment. We need a civilian climate corps. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and I and Bernie Sanders have introduced the legislation for that, and the money is in the Democratic bill in order to have a civilian climate corps that will have hundreds of thousands of young people who will be able to get jobs and go out like the Peace Corps, like AmeriCorps, but there'll be a civilian climate corps that will be enlisting hundreds of thousands of young people. That money is in as well. So we have an incredible, agenda that's inside of the Democrat-only bill, including environmental justice mapping. And if we, if we're smart, wise, and are able to accomplish it, we're going to have all 50 Democrats who will come together to support that package, and then we will be able to put both bills on the desk of the president. And don't forget, the second bill also includes universal pre-K that's free,
right?
Community college, which is free, paid family leave, child tax credits, and a path to citizenship for immigrants in our country.
Yes, it's a huge bill. And I know I keep coming back to this a little bit like a dog with a bone, but I'm going to continue to be a little bit like a dog with a bone on this.
That's good.
You've referred to it a couple of times here as the Democrat-only bill. And I wonder, is it a Democrat-inclusive bill, and is there a rub there? So just this week, Senators Joe Manchin of West Virginia, Kristen Sinema of Arizona expressed concern over the total price tag. You've got to get something out of the House first. We have heard read reports that as many as 10 Democrats who are more centrist might be concerned about letting it out in the $3.5 trillion form that it is. You said if you're smart, you'll get it done. This looks to an outsider like something really hard to get done. So how do you reassure your constituents who want that package you just laid out that it can actually happen?
Well, I think some of their reservations are about taxing the rich, which we do, to pay for this bill, taxing corporations in order to pay for this bill. That sector of the American economy has been the principal beneficiary of generational wealth, which has been created. So we're going to reclaim some of it in order to invest in every other family in the country as well. So I can understand some of their reservations. And so we can be flexible in how that taxation is applied. But I don't think that we should be flexible in terms of the $3.5 trillion goal in terms of total revenues, which is raised, so we can pay for those programs. So a negotiation is now underway, and it should be robust, but I think that ultimately, while we should be flexible on each individual program and the taxes to pay for it, we should not be flexible in terms of the goals that we want to achieve, and the total number, $3.5 trillion, which we have to spend in order to remediate historic injustices.
And Senator Markey, is the whole Massachusetts delegation in the House and the Senate in lockstep on this? The $3.5 trillion, the sequencing, what gets that $3.5 trillion gets spent on?
Yes, we have a very progressive delegation, and we uniformly believe that we can get both done and that we can work towards the political solutions that are going to be needed, especially inside the $3.5 trillion bill, although there might be some changes which the House wants to make in terms of the bipartisan bill that came out of the Senate. But ultimately, yes, this is a moment to legislate. The most popular part of the Democratic bill is taxing billionaires and wealthy corporations to pay for programs for poor people. That is the single highest polling number, even though so many of the other programs poll out very high as well. The child tax credit, free community college. But at the top of the list is where the revenues are going to come from under the Democratic program. And again, we can be flexible in terms of how, you know, within that larger revenue raising goal that we can be, but we have to be firm in terms of our goal to fund these big programs.
So yesterday we had former Massachusetts Governor Michael Dukakis on talking about the packages. I asked him about whether he'd support waiting for the larger spending package before passing the $1.2 trillion smaller package. Here's part of what he said.
I don't think we have an option here. I don't think we've got any alternative. We've got to move on this. This is a very, very important step forward. Can we get the broader package? Yes, I think we probably can, but it's going to be tougher. But in the meantime, I think it would be a mistake to essentially sacrifice what has been a very impressive bipartisan effort.
At the end of the day, if it's necessary, will you just get the $1.2 trillion done and come back to fight another day?
Well, obviously Mike Dukakis was a generational leader for Democrats, including for me, and I think that he's right. That we need the bipartisan bill. That's the roads, the bridges, the broadband, you know. But at the same time, we're at an FDR moment. We need bold action, and we can get it done. We can get it done. I mean, that's what the election of 2020 was all about. It was a mandate, especially from young people, by the way, who voted in overwhelmingly high numbers for this Democratic agenda. And again, we were able to come together in the Senate yesterday morning at 5 a.m. to pass it out, all Democrats voted for it. Now our job is to do the same thing over in the House side, to work with Democrats. And to the extent to which the moderate Democrats in the House want the first bill and all the things that are in it, that's additional leverage for us in our negotiation on the lodger bill. And to give up that leverage, I think, would give up our opportunity to bring them all on board, to have all the Democrats voting for it. And maybe there will be some Republicans in the House as well that would vote for the bigger bill, but I doubt it. So I just think that all these crises are coming together. We're at a point where it's like the Great Depression and the 1918 pandemic with that flu, and the civil rights movement of the 1960s have all come together. And these two bills are the totality of the response to it, a generational response. And I think we can get it done.
That is Massachusetts Senator Ed Markey. Senator, thanks so much for giving us your time.
No, glad to be on with you.
The Boston mayoral primary, just over a month away, September 14th. WBUR and Radio Boston will join WCVB, the Boston Globe, and the McCormick Graduate School of Policy and Global Studies at UMass Boston to bring you a debate among the major candidates on Thursday, September 9th. But between now and then, we're inviting each of them to our virtual studio to make their case to you. And today we have Boston City Councilor Anissa Asaibi-George. Councilor Asaibi-George, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thank you very much, Tiziana. Happy to be here.
So I'm going to start with a question I'm trying to ask everyone. No matter who gets elected in this race, it's going to be a first. So why should that first be you? And why are you the right person to lead the city at this moment?
So I believe I'm the right person to lead this city at this moment based on my experiences as a city councilor and the work I've been able to accomplish on that body, but also my experiences as a small business owner. And I think most importantly, my experience is in the classroom. I spent 13 years as a Boston Public School teacher at East Boston High, and those experiences have certainly given me the ability to jump in the weeds when it comes to issues around educating our kids across the district. But it's also about showing up and being engaged as an at-large city councilor, building relationships with our city's residents in every neighborhood, and being receptive, responsive, and responsible to the needs they have. And that's my commitment as an at-large city councilor and will continue to be my commitment as mayor of the city.
So let's start with COVID, especially there's news today. Acting Boston Mayor Kim Janey announced a vaccine mandate for city employees earlier this afternoon. It was just a bit ago. So here is a bit of what she said.
By the end of the month, all city employees, contractors, and volunteers will be required to verify their vaccination status through a secured, centralized digital portal.
She also said that unvaccinated employees will need to be tested every week. Do you agree with that decision? Is it what you would have done in her shoes?
The most important thing for us to be focused on as a city, whether it's for our city's employees, our city's residents, is to make sure that they have access to vaccination. We have to continue to work on that and make sure that we are getting shots in arms for all of our city's residents. And we need to make sure that we have continued access to testing. One thing that I've noticed is a very dramatic reduction in access to testing. So yes, I agree with pushing vaccination and making sure that our city's residents and our city's employees have access to that vaccination. I don't agree with mandating vaccination. I think it's important to encourage it and to make sure that testing is available.
So I appreciate you clarifying that you don't agree with the mandate part, because that is clearly a fault line in this race. So why not mandate?
Well, I think it's important for us to focus on encouraging our city's workers and our city's residents to get vaccinated and to make sure that if they're not vaccinated, that they are regularly testing, especially those city employees that are in public-facing positions and dealing with the public. But I think a mandate is, you know, it's a dangerous, I think, precedent to start. And we've got to be very careful about those mandates. We've got to be very careful about the messages we're sending to our city's employees, especially if we have not had conversations with them, especially if we have not. And listen, our city's employees have continued to work over the course of this pandemic, have continued to engage in the important efforts around running this city. And if we haven't yet had conversations with them, if we haven't engaged them in this directive, we can't move that far. Not yet, anyway. So, I want to make sure that we are encouraging it across the board and allowing for greater testing.
So let's stay with this for just one more minute. I did wonder earlier this week when Jessica Tang, head of the Boston Teachers Union, came out in favor of a mandate for teachers. I wondered if that would change your mind. As a former educator, you have said in the past, teachers already know it's important to get vaccinated. You're being pretty clear with me right now that you've just laid out why you don't believe in a mandate. But when somebody like the head of the Boston Teachers Union is saying, we want this, do workers know enough? Would you support it in that case?
Well, first, we know that our teachers across the district have seen and realized how important vaccination is. And during last school year, we had a very high rate of vaccination among Boston Public Schools employees, both teaching staff and others. We need to make sure that our city's residents understand how important vaccination is, that we continue to build trust and vaccination and making sure that we're distributing it, especially to our city's employees, that we are continuing with testing. I think it's so important to be vaccinated. I'm vaccinated, and for me, that's very important to do, especially as I engage with the public. It is the question before us around the mandate of vaccination, encouraging it or requiring, so the requirement of vaccination or testing, I'm fine with that, right? Because we're giving options to our city's employees, but we haven't as a city, and I think about the acting mayor, has not yet fully had these discussions and these conversations and understood and hasn't fully understood the needs of our city's employees. And, as a former teacher, I love my former colleagues in the classroom. But there are many more employees that work for the city beyond the teachers, and we need to make sure that we're engaging them fully in that conversation.
Okay. So we're talking to Boston City Councilor and Boston mayoral candidate Anissa Esaibi-George. I'm going to move us on just because there's a bunch I know we have to get to in our time. Let's stay in schools. Let's talk about masks. The CDC is not requiring that all staff and students wear masks. Boston Public Schools are going to. Is that the right move?
Yeah, I have absolutely no problem with the masks. I think we certainly have to think about students who can't wear masks or for various reasons, it makes it difficult for a child to engage in their academics when there is a mask required. But I don't have a problem with that. Kids need to be in school September 8th or 9th, whenever the first day of school is. We need to make sure that we're doing all we can to ensure that that happens.
Any circumstances under which you would foresee, if you were elected, having to shut schools down again? Or is it imperative to keep them open all year?
It is imperative to me that schools are open. Our kids lost so much this last year and a half and most of last school year. And certainly it's about academic learning loss, but it's also about all of the other things that come with being in a school building, the social and emotional services, the ability to engage with one's peers, the social networks that are developed, the enrichment, the athletic, the other programming that happens in a school community, in a school building, the food access, the wellness access. All of those components are so important to our kids, and our children have lost so much. We need to reopen our schools and keep our schools open. And I will work every day today as a city councilor at large to ensure that that happens. And I am committed as mayor to making sure that our schools remain open and our kids have the opportunity to continue to learn, engage in their academics, and all of the other things that come with school.
You've said as mayor, you'd prioritize equity across the public schools, aligning curricula, reallocating funding, focusing on early literacy. What is the first thing, in your opinion, the most urgent reform needed right now to improve the Boston Public Schools?
So the overarching goal, the number one priority is as we look to continue to invest over $1 billion of our city's operating budget, that, our school's budget this year is $1.3 billion, and that doesn't include the federal funding that's coming into the district, that we are always looking to answer the question, how does each dollar invested impact our kids? That those investments, those dollars are student facing, and that every kid has a high quality experience. We talk too often about just creating high quality options. Every seat, every school throughout the district needs to be high quality. That's my priority. That's how I will lead. But certainly, because I'm a classroom teacher, as chair of the Council's Committee on Education, as a BPS grad and a parent of four BPS kids, I know about the weeds as well. Realigning and reimagining our grade configurations across the district, looking at our high school design, making sure that we are providing special education services to all of our kids, that we stop disproportionately placing Black and brown boys in particular into sub-separate classrooms, that we are fulfilling that promise of literacy, especially to our youngest learners. We've got a lot of work to do, and it starts in pre-K, and really it starts well before kids enter our school district, all the way through graduation and beyond, and that we give opportunities to all of our kids every day.
So I want to talk about housing, and we're going to do the toughest part of that first, Counselor. The Boston Globe published a story a couple weeks ago detailing how your office opposed a project in front of the Zoning Board of Appeal that would have blocked the views of a neighboring property, which was a 24-unit luxury condo building in South Boston owned by your spouse. You've said you didn't know about your spouse's involvement, began talking to counsel, quote, as soon as we were made aware of even the potential of a conflict, end quote, in order to address any potential conflicts of interest. I want to ask you, how didn't you know? It would seem that clarity on those dealings and about the extent of the conflict of interest requirements would be paramount for someone in an elected city role.
So this project was not my husband's project that was before the ZBA, and there was no reference to my husband's business. And if there had been, my staff, as they always would do, would have left the room and not participated in any deliberations. I've been on the city council for almost 6 years now, and my staff and I have been steadfast in our commitment to hold ourselves to the highest possible standard and to keep separation between his work and my work on the council. And, you know, this happened here, and my staff, as they always do, took into the consideration the position of the district councilor, of other elected officials, of the community, and most importantly, the community. And as we always do, we work with the neighborhood, we work with the civic associations, we work with our residents and understand their position. And in this case, they were opposed. And as the neighborhood was opposed and the district councilor was opposed, my staff followed suit, as they always do, and also opposed that project. It was not
so
until-
this one-
Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
Just, it wasn't until the Globe brought it to our attention that it was a project that was immediately abutting a project that my husband had been involved in a time period before. And that's when we reached out to legal counsel and have notified and are now working with the State Ethics Commission.
So let's pick it up there. So this one got through. How do you assure voters that something else wouldn't get through if you became mayor? And is there anything you wish you had already had in place?
So we've had great protocol and process in place, and that system has been developed over these many years in office. I do recognize, though, as mayor, I will be held to an even higher standard, and my husband and his business will not be doing any new business here in the city of Boston. I understand, as mayor of the city, I will be appointing boards, the Zoning Board of Appeals, and working certainly to appoint members of the BPDA. So that's obviously a very important component of my work as mayor of this city. And so that's what we've decided to do.
Okay, let's talk about a topic that we've engaged with you really consistently on over the last couple of years, Mass and Cass, the intersection of homelessness and addiction. WBUR's Deb Becker had a story earlier this week about a new syringe collection program. Their goal was 1,000 needles a week. They're typically collecting between 17 and 30,000 needles a week. Now, nearly every candidate has a plan for Mass and Cass. What is different about yours? What sets your approach apart?
So first, I want to congratulate and truly applaud the work of that needle exchange effort that's happening, the needle redemption program that's happening at Mass and Cass. It's very innovative and obviously necessary. And we see that by the numbers that you quoted there in collection. When I took office in 2016, I got to work on this. I was the chair of a committee I founded on homelessness, mental health, and recovery that brought me very directly and very frequently to Mass and Cass to work with individuals who are experiencing homelessness and substance use disorder and mental illness, to work with the providers and the programs that are offering support, the organizations that are working towards rehousing individuals who are unsheltered. And I've continued with great intensity and urgency focused on this issue. Unfortunately, my committee was disbanded, but I've continued in, you know, with as much effort and opportunity to continue to focus on that work. And for me, it's about a continued commitment to serving those that are most vulnerable, working with the community who are greatly impacted by the challenges that happen at Mass and Cass, making sure that we are focused on that issue. And I, through some of our efforts as a, through my role as a city councilor today, and we think about the work that we can do and the opportunity that the ARPA funds bring us, we need to invest some additional dollars in getting people into support, into supportive programs, decentralizing services at the Mass and Cass area, creating opportunities for longer term wellness, rebuilding the Long Island Bridge and investing in longer term programs, working towards family reunification where possible, and making sure that we're thinking about long-term wellness when it comes to Mass and Cass. The Needles in particular, when I took office in 2016, I, with a few other folks, did a little bit of a walk around with the Mobile Sharps team, who was doing not just needle pickup, but outreach. And over that year, they collected about 250,000 needles, I'm sorry. And still, we knew it wasn't enough. And I worked as a member of the council to advocate for and receive additional funding to increase that Mobile Sharps team, that outreach effort. And today we're collecting almost 1 million needles when we think about the number of needles in a year period. Okay. So the work of that collections effort is so important. I applaud it. We'll continue it. We need to invest in those services, as well as many more. When we think about the individual suffering, the residents in that area, the small businesses in that area, we've got to pay attention to Mass and Cass. We've lost sight of that, especially over these last 6 months and to some degree over this last year and a half with COVID. We've got work to do to help the most vulnerable.
All right. That is Boston City Councilor and mayoral candidate Anissa Asaibi-George. Appreciate you joining us. Thanks.
Thank you, Tiziana.
Makeba McCreary joined the MFA during its racial reckoning. She's leaving now to run a $30 million fund raised by local leaders of color during the whole nation's racial reckoning. McCreary finishes as chief of learning and community engagement at the Museum of Fine Arts this week and is the incoming president of the New Commonwealth Racial Equity and Social Justice Fund. The fund was founded in June of 2020 by a coalition of Black and Brown business and community leaders in Massachusetts. They envisioned a philanthropy that explicitly supports nonprofits fighting systemic racism and that have leaders of color. Makeba McCreary joins us now. Makeba, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thank you for having me.
Makeba, this is big. This is arguably an entirely new era for leadership of color in Boston. And I wonder what it means to you to be the first to run a fund that is exclusively dedicated in this way and raised by the Black and Brown leaders of our community.
You know, Tiziana, it just feels right. Like it feels like it's the exact right thing to do at this moment. And I can't really imagine myself doing anything differently. I don't know if that makes sense, but it's sort of like the stars aligned and my soul sort of said, this is exactly the path that you need to be taking.
It does. I do understand that. And I wonder, I found myself thinking as you were saying that, okay, so when you heard about the fund back last summer, summer of 2020, were you like, oh, that's got to be me. I got to do that.
No, I think I was so taken with how proud I was of all of these colleagues of mine, you know, across the city who figured it out. Like they actually put their finger right on it and said, we have to do this together. That's how this gets solved for. All of us have been working on these issues independently in lots of different forums, personally, professionally, but to come together in one room, in one space and say, we need to raise some real money, we need to be identifying some real leadership, and we need to make sure that we are calling out unapologetically that there are Black and Brown leaders across this Commonwealth who are solving this problem. They are doing it, but they need more financial and probably also thought partnership and other resources to get it done.
Sometimes there is a tension between righting the wrongs of the past and building the future that we want to see. And that's probably as true as anywhere else when it comes to racial justice, social equity, making these investments. It's a tension, I'm white, but I know that it is a tension that Black and Brown leaders have disproportionately been tasked with resolving. How do you think about that tension? How do you balance that tension?
It might be where I am in my own personal path at this moment, but I have less interest in righting wrongs. I have much more interest in investing in the solutions that are right in front of us that we know work, that we know will make sure that there is equitable access to high quality education, that healthcare is available, and that there are not food deserts only in Black and brown communities, that there are opportunities for people to enter the workforce and not just, you know, live check to check, but actually thrive and be their own creatives. So that's what I want to be a part of. And that's what I think that the New Commonwealth Fund's real core is at the core of making an impact is moving forward and talking about what the asset model is for Black and brown folks out here.
What is that asset model?
Well, we certainly know how to survive. We know how to survive in institutions and in communities, in cities, in states where we are not prioritized, where our health and wellness is not lifted up as a priority. And I don't mean that just from a physical health and wellness. I mean also spiritually and emotionally. And we've just lived through, you know, 12, 18 months where that was just exacerbated because there was, it just became, I think, so clear that folks who are already struggling were just blown away by this pandemic. And if you had the privilege of even being able to walk to a grocery store or walk to a green space and not be surrounded by 15 to 20 other people, you actually had a shot at staying healthy. And so hard to go backwards from there. I think the covers have been lifted, and it's just it's impossible for us to not acknowledge the fact that racism and bias and really just exclusion from being able to prosper is no longer acceptable. And we have ways to address that. We have 19, now 20, I'd like to count myself as one of them, people who've come together and said, you know, we're going to lock arms and we're going to get this done together.
I think about that number, I think 19 or 20. And then I think about the larger philanthropic landscape in the city. So you've got, you know, you've got the Boston Foundation and you've got the Barr Foundation. Are they locking arms with you too? Are you needing to lead and they're going to have to follow? I mean, you and I first met each other when I was also in philanthropy, and we know how hard it is to make investments that center communities of color and leaders of color.
What I can tell you is that the first one or two phone calls I got were from both of those foundations' leaders, and the statement was, we're here to be right next to you as you move forward, and we're really, really excited for what's to come. You know, I'm not naive. There are lots of other stakeholders involved in the other foundations across the city, and there's a lot of legacy that they themselves have to sort through and decide how they might rearrange their priorities. But I do feel supported, and I do feel like there should absolutely be an opportunity for shared leadership. I'm happy to follow, but I also know that there will be moments when New Commonwealth Fund will be able to get out in front of this in a way that they may not be able to. And I hope that they will be ready to walk right next to us as well.
Tell us about some organizations in the city that you're really excited about, that you think are the, you said a little earlier in our conversation, we know what some of these solutions are. So who are some of the vibrant organizations in our community that are giving out, that's not at all the right word, that are working on the kinds of solutions you're talking about?
So what I will talk about is the kinds of work that's happening. I'm going to stay away from the actual organizations because that's a slippery slope.
Because you're a human starting gun? Okay, but the models. Let's talk about the models, right? The models that are exciting. Yeah.
I think for sure models that do identify that if an organization is serving a specific community, that leadership reflects that community, that they are close to it, they are proximal. I think that there's a lot of really small groups of folks, like I guess we want to call them grassroots. I'm not sure how I feel about that term anymore, but folks who are really close to the ground, who are doing the work day to day, the very forward facing work, and they may not be doing it at the scale that shows up for the media and or for our philanthropies, but they absolutely are talking and touching the needs of the people that they are there to serve very, very intimately. And I think that they should not be overlooked. And then I think that there's a really great opportunity for us to look to models from other sectors that might be really applicable and transfer some solutions to things that we haven't been able to unravel yet. And so I don't actually know exactly what those might be, but I have to imagine that, you know, if we look to the tech sector, if we look to but I don't know, is there something that folks who are working on clean energy, you know, could teach us about how you address an issue that feels really just stubborn and unable to be solved for. So I look forward to all sort of three different ways of approaching this work.
I'm thinking a lot about Janae Osterholt's writings on Black joy for the Boston Globe. And this is a heavy time. You are taking on big systemic issues in this new role. That work can be done joyfully, but I also wonder, are there other ways that you want to invest in joy as well?
Oh, that's such a great question. let's give Janae a shout out. She has carried us through a tide of moments over through the pandemic. And I just visualized right now the graphic that goes with her her stories. You know, we, as a person of color, as a Black woman, these issues, that they aren't so huge. Like they are every day. They are very familiar. So it's hard for me to think about how you take on something that is so huge without acknowledging that Black and brown folks every day are dealing with racism in all parts of their world. And they must stay joyful, or my goodness, we wouldn't show up anymore. So I think there's joy in, you know, being able to know that you can do your small part, that you can do a larger part. There's also just joy in me seeing my son, you know, happy. He's got a job at a veterinarian this summer. There's joy in me walking through the museum on my final days and seeing little kids, you know, running around and looking at Equa Holmes art on the wall, a Roxbury Black female artist who is taking up two galleries right now. And then certainly there's joy in thinking about the opportunity to raise another $70 million to get to 100 million, right? So that we can really think about across the Commonwealth how to lift up the leaders that are, again, at all sorts of altitudes, addressing racism, addressing oppression, and also thinking about how to make sure our young people and our families the rest of us are thriving and are going to be successful.
We're talking with Makeba McCreary, the president of the New Commonwealth Fund. Makeba, this is your last week, as I understand it, at the Museum of Fine Arts. What's the legacy there? What are you most proud of?
Certainly what I just described, you know, being able to walk through the galleries and see palpably more young people of color. It's real. To see more families, to see more 20-somethings, as soon as we reopened, folks were back in here, and that felt really good, and it felt different. It felt different because there's different things on the walls, there's different stories being told. I certainly am really proud of my team, of the folks who had to figure out how to close a museum and reopen a museum, and then we closed another time, and stay really present and also keep it at the forefront, the fact that we want people who can walk to the museum to choose us. And in some ways, I think that the pandemic really showed a light on the fact that you know, we typically were very comfortable with the idea that we had a clientele that might fly into Logan Airport. And now we have to get really comfortable with the fact that the folks we want here live across the street, you know, or can drive here in 15 minutes. And so I think it's a new day in many ways. And then, of course, in a lot of other ways, there's still some really important work to get done. And I think the last thing I would say is that there are folks here who really want to see that happen. And I hope that I was able to be a partner to them and to mirror some of that for the time that I was here.
Very briefly on that, what's a piece of unfinished business, briefly?
I said this in my Globe article, and I think I'll stick to it, which is I think that the hiring of other people of color here is really important. Representation matters on the walls, and it matters as people who are wearing badges. So
I wonder, is there a person, Makiba, from your childhood, earlier in your career, maybe, if not your childhood, who inspired you, believed in you? And in your mind, what are they whispering in your ear now as you start on this new adventure?
Absolutely. Yeah, my father, and he's probably listening right now, but my father always said to me, you are beautiful, you are intelligent, you are capable of doing and being anything that you want to be, even if you are told otherwise. Never believe that. I think right now he's maybe not whispering so much, but shouting that I think he's really, really proud of the fact that I am getting an opportunity to work with Black and Brown folks on Black and Brown issues, supporting Black and Brown people. Like, that's the triad that I think for a man from Mobile, Alabama, who came to Boston in his, you know, early years, is really excited to know that I'm going to have the chance to spend my days doing that work.
And in, you know, 15 seconds, anything you want to say back to him?
Oh boy. There's more to come. We have a lot more work to do, and he's probably going to write me a note and leave it on my table when I get home. So I'm sure there's another interview to happen soon.
All right. That is Makiba McCreary, who's finishing as Chief of Learning and Community Engagement at the Museum of Fine Arts and is the incoming president of the new Commonwealth Racial Equity and Social Justice Fund. Makiba, appreciate the time. Thanks. I hope you'll come back and talk to us again when you're in the role.
I will. Thank you.
And that's our show for today. Radio Boston is produced by Jamie Bologna, Chris Siderick, Walter Wuthman, Amanda Beland, and Cynthia Betubiza. We had help from Ali Audette and Stephen Gelman. Marquise Neal is our technical director. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi. I'm Tiziana Deering. Hey, join us again tomorrow. It's Friday then, so it'll be Radio Boston's Week in Review.